Howdy, y'all. Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on the Liberty Radio Network, LRN.FM, and LibertyRadioNetwork.com. My website is scotthorton.org. You can find all of my stuff there, including 3,000 interviews. Actually, it's about 3,300, something like that, nowadays, going back to 2003. And they're almost all with Ray McGovern and Eric Margolies, who are both going to be back on the show today. Yeah, them and Phil Giraldi and Gareth Porter. Over and over and over and over. Well, they're great on everything. What am I supposed to do? Not interview them all the time about everything that they write? Come on. Ray McGovern, he's going to be on today. Robert Perry, who is an associate of Ray's, he's a journalist, former AP and Newsweek reporter from Iran-Contra days and the Reagan years, runs consortiumnews.com. Well, Ray McGovern writes there, and he's a former CIA guy. And Perry says that he has a source who says that CIA analysts say that maybe Kiev's military, rather than the separatists, shot down the plane in eastern Ukraine, the Malaysian airliner, civilian airliner. Killing almost 300 people. So, I don't know about that, but I know that Perry wrote a thing saying he has a source that says that CIA says that, and I know that Ray knows CIA and Ray knows Perry. So, I'm going to have Ray on and see what he can comment. He didn't tell me what he's going to comment, but he said yes, he can comment on that. So, good. Good enough for me. Ray McGovern on the show, former CIA, to talk about the mess going on in Ukraine. And we'll have lots of talking about that going on the show. Well, the whole thing, as well as the crash and whatever, on the show today. And then Eric Margolies is going to be here about his article, David versus Goliath in Gaza. And so that should be great. I also have an invite out to Human Rights Watch over this cool report that they did about trumped up charges and government entrapments in the Department of Justice's domestic war on terrorism, not the civilian slaughter and the prison without trial at Bagram and Guantanamo and beneath Mogadishu. And I forgot the name of that prison, but no, the ones where you get a fair trial with a black robe federal judge and a jury and the FBI and the Department of Justice civilian authorities go after people for on terrorism charges. HRW's done a study, and they decided that it's a bunch of crap. I told you I was going to write a book like this before, and the publishers said, "Eh, no one will buy it." We should just self-publish the thing. Me and Giraldi were going to write it about all the fake terrorism cases, and in fact, Trevor Aronson from Mother Jones actually ended up doing a book about it called The Terror Factory. It's a great study at Mother Jones magazine. It's also a book, The Terror Factory. It's about the FBI. And not just all the trumped up charges like this HRW report, but 50, at least 50 individuals entrapped, outright stung by the FBI into crossing some line and getting prosecuted on terrorism charges. So, great book, by the way. I read the whole thing, and I interviewed Trevor Aronson about it, if you ever want to hear that. All right. Anyway, so, now, here's the thing. There's so much to talk about, including Iraq, including I want to play a great clip of James Garner, and, who died. And I want to talk about Syria, and I want to talk about, obviously, current events in Palestine on the show today as well. But a few different people have asked me to comment on this video put out by Dennis Prager, who is a conservative talk show host. Some very, very well done flash animation. Explaining Israel's side of the story, which is fair enough. And basically the tag that I've gotten along with this from the Twitterers is, yep, my dad sent me this. This is what America's conservative dads are emailing around to each other. Just to remind you, in case you needed to, you know, a reminder, let's just go ahead and reinforce our illusions and that kind of thing. So that's cool with me. Let them try, and I will try to explain. And this is going to take more than one segment for sure, and it's unfortunate because the way I stagger my interviews today, I don't really have a... I don't know, maybe I should wait an hour and give it a good full half hour treatment, because I've already wasted much of this segment talking about coming on the show and FBI terrorism bullshit. Well, anyway, I'll tell you what, let me fill you in on the headlines on Gaza. 532 Gazans have been killed so far. 20 Israelis have been killed. 18 of them soldiers. One of them a volunteer who was helping the soldiers at the front. 80% of the Palestinian dead are civilians. 94% of the Israeli dead are soldiers. In case anybody's keeping score about who's targeting civilians and who's got good aim. Obama this morning gave a short talk and urged ceasefire and said he's sending John Kerry over there to get a ceasefire. Well, the problem with that, first of all, is it's John Kerry. But the other problem with that is he sent him to Egypt. Well, the Egyptians don't want a ceasefire. The Egyptians don't care. The Egyptian military dictatorship don't give a damn about what happens to Hamas or anybody else in the Gaza Strip. And the Palestinians have already said they want Qatar, not Field Marshal Sisi, the elected fascist military dictator of Egypt, to help them broker a deal. So what the hell kind of deal is that? All Obama has done, really, is serve to remind us that, oh, this is his responsibility, actually. That Benjamin Netanyahu really is no more than a state governor in the American empire. And haven't you ever heard Jack Kennedy on the phone with the governor of Mississippi, or was it Alabama, saying, hey, listen, I'm sorry, you and I don't want to fight about this, not a real fight, but let me just remind you that the army will defeat your National Guard forces. Am I making myself clear? Now, obviously, Obama wouldn't have to go that far. But all he would have to do really is just tell Netanyahu, listen, I'm going to go on TV and I'm going to tell the American people the truth about you. I'm going to tell on you to my bosses, the American people. And once they understand the facts of life of the occupation, they're going to be on the Palestinian side. So do what I say. Or he could also say, I'm not going to give you $3 billion, and I'm not going to give you a bunch of free fighter jets. And you're going to have to murder people on your own dime. See how the Israelis like having their taxes raised to pay for your mass murder all the time. Good luck. Or any number of things. The buck stops with President Obama. Same thing as when Field Marshal Sisi is slaughtering people in the streets in Cairo. It's Field Marshal Obama's responsibility, since Egypt is just a mere satellite of the American empire, primarily so that we can pay them to pretend to not hate Israel. But anyway, so at least we're getting our money's worth out of the Egyptians for that. We're getting Egyptian terrorists, turning against our country in response. But, you know, being in government means never having to weigh consequences. All right. When we get back, you know what? I guess I'll cover Iraq. And then later on in the show, I'll get to the Prager thing when I have a full half hour. Because it's going to take a full half hour to go through, I think. Which means, you know, 2 10-minute segments. So when we get back, Iraq news, and then Ray McGovern. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Man, Iraq news. In Mosul, Iraqi Christians told they must convert, pay tax, or die. Convert, pay tax, or die. Wait, no, I still didn't emphasize that right. How did I emphasize that right? I think they got to convert and pay the tax. It's not three different choices. It's two things and then the choice. Or die. The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. The Islamic State. The Caliphate. George Bushistan. Followed today's Friday prayers with a release of new documents in Mosul ordering the city's Christian community to either agree to convert to Islam or pay the jizya tax, saying they face death as a last resort. You know, like a black man in New York City. Pay your tax or we'll kill you. That's what a state is. Looks like the caliphate is really coming into its own, guys. At one point, Mosul had a fairly large Christian minority, estimated over 3,000. Most are believed to have fled when ISIS first invaded, however, and it isn't clear how many are even left. The move appeared to be in line with what ISIS did in Raqqa, that's in Syria, formerly known as Eastern Syria, where the Christian community entered into a diminutive agreement involving the payment of gold dinars, smaller amounts for poor families, to remain Christian under ISIS rule. Jizya was originally intended as an equivalent to the zakat payments Muslims are required to make, during an era when those charitable contributions were largely managed by Muslim states. The idea was that jizya would prevent the cost of the zakat being a conversion obstacle. Makes sense. In addition to getting, you know, if you have a theocracy and everything. In addition to getting legal permission to continue to practice the non-state religion, jizya payers are traditionally also exempt from conscription. Many Iraqi Christians, those who didn't flee during the bloody U.S. occupation, have fled northward into Iraqi Kurdistan, and it is unclear how many remain at all in ISIS territory. In Syria, however, Christians have largely not been able to flee so easily, and ISIS retains a significant Christian minority in Raqqa and Deir Ezzor. Deir Ezzor. Anyway, yeah, so there you go. There are hardly any Christians left in Iraq, at least, you know, to compare. Oh, good. Here's the HRW people. Let's see. Andrew, let's see if she can. One or three. Oh, I don't have three open. I got. Anyway, we'll see what happens there. That's what breaks are for. Read your email at the break, Scott. Oh, okay. And here's Patrick Coburn. That was Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. This is Patrick Coburn. Time runs out for Christian Iraq. The ultimatum imposed by militants for Christians to convert to Islam, pay a tax, or be killed has passed with the collapse of communities that have existed for millennia, is the way Patrick Coburn puts it. Boy, I should have got him on the show today about this. Well, anyway, we'll catch up with him later in the week, that's for sure. And, you know, speaking of Coburn, he's the guy that says that, you know, he compares the Islamic State leadership to the Khmer Rouge. And you know, he and Prothero agree. I know Margulies doesn't quite agree, but then again, Margulies hadn't been in Iraq like they have lately. They seem to agree that ISIS certainly has the upper hand among the Sunni leadership right now, anyway. It's not the same dynamic as it was back when the American government pretended that every Sunni attack was al-Qaeda in Iraq, motivated only by terrorist nihilism rather than a Sunni insurgency against an American effort to put Iran's sock puppets in power in Baghdad and cleanse it of its Sunni population. Who made up the term cleanse for forced relocations of people? And why do I keep using it? Always building the caveat that it's some sick liberal's term or something, right? But still. Anyway. They seem to have the upper hand, according to Prothero and Coburn, these ISIS guys. And you know, Prothero calls them school shooters. Only now with real military experience and training. Coburn calls them the Khmer Rouge. And, you know, they are nihilists. They are completely, well, their tactics are centered around absolute brutality to get their way, to frighten and cow and to provoke. And they crucify their enemies in the town square. They're as ruthless as any American governor, in other words. As any American county sheriff. And anyway, so what they're coming to do here is, what they mean to do is kill as many Shia as they can. Limited only by their ability to kill Shia. And they feel the same way about the Christians, the Maronites and the Chaldean and Assyrian Christians that have lived there for 2,000 years. Millennia plural, as Coburn puts it. The Yazidis and the Turkmen and the all the other different little, the Shabak, the Druze, all the different little minorities that have lived in Mesopotamia since before it was even Arab land, right? These tiny little ancient sects, Assyrians who still speak the language of Jesus, Aramaic, they've basically been obliterated from Iraqi society already. They're hiding in the hills up in Kurdistan. The last few thousand in Mosul, how the hell did they survive the war? Maybe these are people who have come home from Syria since America started backing the jihad in that country. And so they're Iraqis who fled their refugee camps and come home. Anyway, you know, hopefully they're safe behind Kurdish lines, at least for now. They're not safe in Syrian refugee camps anymore, that much is for sure. All right. This is very important. Mitchell Prothero, I'm going to try and see if I can get him back on the show tomorrow. Islamic State overwhelms Iraqi forces at Tikrit in major defeat. And this goes along to my theory, what I've been telling you this whole time. There's still a lot of battles to come, but you know what? I think it's sort of like World War I. You can see a lot of people killed, no doubt about it, but the lines aren't going to move very much now. What's happened now is that the West and the Northwest have broken off from the South and East. Arab, Sunni, jihadi, George Bushistan versus Shiite Iranistan in the South. But neither have the ability to conquer the other. Nor will they soon. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betray their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy. The OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. You know, that hardly ever happens. It's on random kind of thing on the playlist the computer picks. But, so that's kind of nice. Playing Stiff Little Fingers for our Irish friend Ray McGovern on the phone here. Irish-American. He's a former CIA analyst for 27 years, and he is a co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And no, this isn't a rerun. This is a brand new interview live here today, July the 21st, 2014. Ray McGovern from RayMcGovern.com and also ConsortiumNews.com. Welcome back to the show, Ray. How's it going?
Well, the top of the morning to you, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. Thank you very much for joining us. And so here's the big deal. You got this friend, Robert Perry, over there at ConsortiumNews.com. He's a famous journalist from Newsweek and AP back in the days of Iran-Contra and ever since, writing about them damn Republicans and the neocons especially. And he's got this place, Consortium News, and you right there, too. And he has an article called, What Did U.S. Spy Satellites See in Ukraine? And in this article, he cites a source that cites CIA analysts saying what? And what can you tell us about his source and what he knows and whether you know it, too, etc.?
Well, Scott, I can tell you this, that there are, I was going to say a handful. There are two handfuls of reputable investigative journalists left in this country. Bob Perry is at the top of that list. He quit because they wouldn't let him tell the truth. Newsweek, AP, Frontline, the whole schmear. He has his own website now, and he does not publish stuff that is frivolous. Now, we knew back last September, when the last time war loomed on the near horizon, namely a U.S. attack on Syria, we knew that some of our former colleagues in CIA disputed John Kerry when he said no fewer than 35 times on August 30th at the State Department, quote, we know, end quote, we know, quote, end quote. Okay. We know that it was Bashar al-Assad and the government forces that launched that chemical attack on August 21st, 9 days ago. We know. Okay. Now, you don't have to be a Shakespearean scholar to be a little suspicious of people protesting too much, right? We looked at the evidence and we heard from our friends. And this is important. These were friends who weren't going to do a redux of the fraudulent intelligence served up to, quote, justify, end quote, war in Iraq in February, March, that's when it started, March 2003. So they said, no, no deal. We're not gonna prepare an intelligence assessment for you, Kerry, to support yourself on saying we know, because we don't know, okay? We didn't know then. We think we know now. The evidence is pretty conclusive that it was not pretty conclusive. To me, I am persuaded that it was not the Bashar al-Assad government that perpetrated those attacks. Rather, it was the rebels. We knew the rebels had sarin gas. But we also knew that the evidence served up later by the New York Times, even Human Rights Watch, did not bear close scrutiny. So the point here is simply that not only did my former colleagues, and I'm very proud to say this after some of the fiascos of former years, stand up to Kerry, but Kerry had to have something sui generis, something unique in my experience prepared, and that was a, quote, government assessment, end quote, bereft of any verifiable detail. So he couldn't get an intelligence assessment. He put out a government assessment, which is full of lies and bereft of any detail. So that's really important background here. We're hearing from some of the same folks who are warning us that, you know, they've told the president, they've served up the ambiguous but, you know, sort of persuasive evidence, and the president has decided in his wisdom to do exactly what Reagan did back in 1983. Recall when the Russians shut down an intruding aircraft. It turned out to be KAL, Korean Airlines 007. It strayed off course and went over Kamchatka, it was in Siberia. It refused instructions to land, and it was dark, and they didn't know it was a airliner. They thought, and it's very clear from their own intercepted communications, they thought it was an intelligence Air Force plane that wouldn't heed instructions. And so they shot it down, deliberately. Yeah, they shot it down. Now, what was the mantra that Schultz and Reagan and Weinberger all recited for the next 3 weeks? Russia deliberately shot down a civilian plane over Siberia. Now, half truth, right? Half truths are worse than full falsehoods, in my view. Yeah, it was deliberate, but they didn't know it was KAL 007. There had been an RC-135 intelligence collector in the same area just hours before. Why do I mention that? Because it's directly relevant to the situation now. Now we have a situation where we don't know all the facts. They're very ambiguous. And what the U.S. administration has decided to do, before the evidence is in, before the inspection team has a reasonable chance to look at what happened, they're serving up propaganda, outright propaganda. Putin bad, very bad. No shirt on sometimes. When he rides on horses, Putin really bad. He's responsible for the whole thing. Well, the evidence is not in, and it's not persuasive. And to their credit, some of my former colleagues are saying, kick the tires, McGovern. Kick the tires on this one, because it's very similar to what we faced on Syria back last fall. You'll recall that Obama reversed his decision to attack Syria within 24 hours after John Kerry said on the 30th of August, we know it was Bashar al-Assad who violated the red line that the president set against the use of chemical weapons. So we're in that interim period now. Who's lying now on the Ukraine thing? John Kerry is lying. You know why? Because he says, we know. And he doesn't know, okay? So is Putin lying? Well, what has Putin said? He said, hey, let's wait for the investigation, for Pete's sake. You know, let's get this thing underway. And meanwhile, let's have a ceasefire. Now, one of the things that the president said over the weekend was that there should be an international investigation team and there should be a ceasefire. Now, why is that relevant? Because Washington has endorsed Kiev's offensive in the east until now, refusing to join the Russians, the French, and the Germans in calling for a ceasefire. So Obama has now called for a ceasefire. I thought that was a really good sign. And I wake up this morning and I see that Kiev forces are raising hell out there in the eastern Ukraine, not very far, 50 miles, they say, from the crash site, raising hell and attacking the rebel forces there. So, you know, this couldn't be more cynical. I mean, Washington could simply call up Yatsenyuk and say, look, knock it off. Knock it off at least until we can find out what happened there when that plane was shut down. And Washington will not even do that. You know, I've never seen the like of it, Scott, and I've seen a lot of bad stuff.
All right. Well, so let's rewind to the beginning here. Again, everybody, we're talking with Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, veteran intelligence professional for Sanity. That's the name of the group, professionals in there with the plural there. And, well, they try to truth us out of war all the time. That's basically what they do. And so now back to, well, first of all, the sources and what it is that they're saying. Oh, crap. And now the music's playing already. Ray, hold it right there. Yes, I'm terrible at doing radio, okay? But I'm interested in what is going on, and so you all tolerate me, the few of you who listen. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Ray McGovern from RayMcGovern.com and ConsortiumNews.com. Check Bob Perry's second to the top headline on anti-war today. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm me, Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on Liberty Radio Network, ScottHorton.org. Stop by the chat room. Talking with Ray McGovern, again, a former CIA analyst, now peacenik, co-founder of the group Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and writer for ConsortiumNews.com. We're talking about his colleague Robert Perry's article, What Did U.S. Spy Satellites See in Ukraine? And from the way you talk, Ray, sounds like his sources are yours, or he says source singular here. Can you be any more specific? Are you saying to us, because you know how it is with the news, a former CIA officer says something, that kind of is a news story itself, because the implication is he knows, because he's talking to people who have the classified information, and they're telling him that, hey, man, here's what you should say to the people. And so in this case, are we correct then to infer that what's going on here is there are current CIA analysts who are leaking to you, Ray McGovern, and to Robert Perry, your colleague, that what exactly now? Because what you said was, hey, Ray, you ought to kick these tires and make sure, you know, the implication being the car is going to fall apart if you do. But Perry is much more specific here in what he claims y'all are being told. So please explain.
Sure. Well, there was a little irony there, perhaps unintended, when you say that of previous CIA analysts with all kinds of awards and stuff like that is news. Well, ironically, it's news in Russia.
Yeah.
I'm in Evening Moscow today on the front page of their print paper and was gave them an interview early Sunday morning. But I don't get the
Well,
time.
Listen, if you were pro-war, you would be the expert on CNN. There's no shortage of former CIA guys willing to spout war party talking points paraded on TV all day.
Yeah,
that's all I meant was... You know, if they wanted to quote you, the fact that you're former CIA and say you know something would count as you yourself, even as a retired officer, are credible as a source to cite.
Sure. No, I was just playing with you there, Scott.
I've been
sickened by Bob Baer and some of the other people who know better but get really well paid by CNN and other places. It's really kind of really, really sad. Anyhow. What you asked had to do with sources, and I can tell you this, that Bob Perry is a professional journalist. He would not go with a source without whom, unless he had very good experience with this person. I happen to know that he does have good experience with her. And I can't say any more than that, other than the fact that it's his source. But on Friday, as soon as I learned about all this stuff, I wrote that article. I think we talked about it on the phone from some kind of a bus. That the important thing here was to kick the tires of any truck that's carrying sophisticated intercepts or other information showing. That the rebels or the Russians did it. There's all manner of possibility to falsify, to toy with this, and we saw that in the KAL affair that I mentioned before from 1983. We saw it with Colin Powell's presentation justifying, in quotes, war with Iraq on February 5th, 2003. So, you know, every 20 years we get a chance to say, hey, NSA, delete the sections that are exculpatory and make sure you make out the Russians to be evil incarnate. And that's what they're doing so far. To the degree they serve up satellite information, I'll be really interesting to see whether it bears close scrutiny. And all I'll say about Bob's latest article is that it makes eminent good sense to show the pictures. Everyone knows that we have pictures. There are sophisticated ways of disguising the resolution that we get. You know, if we can read license plates, well, that's pretty good resolution. You can downgrade that resolution to the point where people, enemies, cannot find out how precisely detailed your information is. The other thing I'll say is that there is ample precedent for releasing sensitive information. Now, Ronald Reagan, back when the Libyans were doing terrorism galore and blew up a Berlin bistro, killing, I think, four or five American soldiers and many other civilians, he knew from an intercepted message that it was the Libyans. And so he, I don't justify, you know, killing grandsons and that kind of thing, but he did attack Gaddafi's compound and killed one of his sons, I believe, and did all manner of other things for which he was excoriated by the world. So he came to us and he said, look, you know, we have to release this intercept, otherwise nobody's going to believe me. And we all said, of course, no, no, you can't do that. No, no, please, please, you know, you blow our source. This is a great source we have intercepting this kind of communications. Let me... And he said, do it. And we did it. The Fuhrer, subsided. We have other ways of collecting the same information. And there was no real harm to the national security, but there was great repair to the national image. So what I'm saying here is if they have satellite photography proving, as they claim, mm-hmm. that there was a whole convoy of trucks, including these kinds of missiles, that left Ukraine, go back into Russia after this incident, they ought to show those photos. And if they don't, well, we need to kick the tires even harder.
All right. Well, for benefit of the audience, what Perry writes here today, again, the article is, what did U.S. spy satellites see in Ukraine? And Perry says, what I've been told by one source who has provided accurate information on similar matters in the past, the source that you just vouched for as credible to you as well, is that U.S. intelligence agencies do have detailed satellite images of the likely missile battery that launched the fateful missile, but the battery appears to have been under the control of Ukrainian government troops dressed in what looked like Ukrainian government uniforms. And he goes on to say the analysts are not ruling out the possibility that the troops were actually Eastern Ukrainian rebels in similar uniforms, but the initial assessment was that the troops were Ukrainian soldiers. So, you know, that's a huge story that, you know, exists nowhere in cable TV news or in any newspaper that I've heard of other than that. So that's a lot more specific than just, you know, keep asking tough questions, Ray.
Yeah, and besides that, you know, you have to kick all the tires, including the Russian tires. But the Russian Defense Ministry has issued a statement saying Kyiv is lying again. Kyiv, the Ukrainian government, is saying we had no radar, we had no missiles within range to down that civilian aircraft. Okay, that's a lie, says the Russian Defense Minister. We not only know that they had a radar in the area, but it was active. It was active at the time of the shootdown, and we know they had at least two missile batteries in position, in range, to be able to shoot it down. So again, and actually some of the Russian diplomats have come close to calling Poroshenko and others liars. What they say is that their record for telling truthful things over the last month or so is not very good, and that happens to be the truth. So you got to, you know, pick your medicine. But right now, I think the only sensible, honest answer is we don't know. Kerry doesn't know. Piling up all this evidence, he still uses a little bit of the subjunctive mood. But when you look at what he did last September, when he said on the 30th of August, that 35 times we know that it was the government of Syria that did these chemical attacks. Then on the 4th, on the 3rd of September, he goes before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and he says the same thing in more graphic detail. And guess what? On the 4th of September, Putin, and this is highly unusual, Putin comments on Kerry's testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee the previous day on Syria, and Putin says Kerry is a liar. Now, I haven't heard Putin. I can't recall any other president or prime minister of another country calling someone a liar, and particularly in these heavily charged, emotionally charged situations. So, you know, when Putin is listening to all this stuff, he knew, and of course Lavrov and others, actually Lavrov, the foreign minister, has quoted veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, because we served up a memorandum to the president that said Kerry didn't know. We are hearing from our colleagues that it's quite the opposite. So the bottom line here is we should keep our powder dry, and our hope, my hope at least, is that the Europeans will be more sensible than Kerry. They know that Kerry is inclined to play fast and loose with the truth. So we hope that maybe they can talk some sense into Washington.
Thanks very much. Ray McGovern, everybody. ConsortiumNews.com. Hey, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our next guest is Maria McFarlane from Human Rights Watch. And they've got a brand new report out, Illusion of Justice, Human Rights Abuses in U.S. Terrorism Prosecutions. You can see the pretty lengthy and informative splash here at hrw.org. It's U.S. Terrorism Prosecutions, Often an Illusion. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Maria?
Thanks very much. I'm doing well. Thanks.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here, and thank you for doing this work. It's such an important story, and there was a time where hardly anyone would point this out. I almost wrote a book about it at one point myself a few years ago, but was told I wouldn't be able to get it published, so don't bother kind of thing, and I probably should have anyway. But anyway, what a great story, and it's not focused exclusively on the 50 or so, probably closer to 60 now, outright entrapment jobs, as Trevor Aronson has documented in his great book, The Terror Factory. But you go beyond that and talk about a lot of the kind of just trumped up charges, too, that, you know, on TV and the Orange Alert and everything, it sounds like, oh, my God, they saved us from an Al-Qaeda sleeper cell. But it turns out it was much less than that. But anyway, so I was hoping you could focus more on that angle than the outright entrapments, but we could talk about entrapments too. But anyway, I'll let you just go ahead and give us an overview of this thing here. I'm very excited, you can tell.
Sure, yeah. Well, since 9/11, there have been nearly 500 terrorism-related prosecutions, according to the federal government. And I'm sure many of those involved people who were, in fact, planning or financing terrorist acts. But when we took a close look at 27 of those cases involving over 70 defendants, we found abuses at all stages of the case, from the moment of investigation, where in many cases we found the FBI did lure people into the supposed terrorist acts, through to trial, where often material support charges are used that are overly broad, where there's inflammatory evidence that is introduced, and on through to the punishment phase, where not only are people being punished with excessively harsh sentences due to the terrorism enhancement, which leads to basically a minimum 17-year sentence, as well as the problem of solitary confinement. Many of the people who end up with terrorism convictions are held in solitary confinement, sometimes pre-trial, and many others are under SAM, special administrative measures, which prohibit their contact with anybody except prison guards for extended periods of time. And all of those...
And you're saying pre-trial, they're isolated like that even pre-trial. Or both?
We found a lot of cases of solitary confinement pretrial for months on
okay.
end.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I'm sorry. So, please continue.
Yeah. So you're basically with a situation where somebody could just be a vulnerable person, mentally ill, poor, who wants money. And they get targeted by the FBI. Usually these are people in American Muslim communities, at least those are the ones we focused on. who gets picked on by an informant, convinced to take some steps towards a terrorist act, and then get prosecuted in these unfair trials and then locked up for decades in these horrific conditions. Mm. And that's just unjust. It's cruel to the people involved, to their families, but it's also having a pretty profound impact on American Muslim communities, which are precisely the communities that the Obama administration and the FBI have repeatedly said they want to work with as partners to prevent terrorism. Instead, these sorts of abusive investigations and prosecutions are creating fear and mistrust and a sense among these communities that they're constantly being watched and that they can't trust any outsiders.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, yeah, a lot of important things to go back over there. One thing I want to hit on or let you elaborate on would be what you just mentioned there about it's mostly Muslims, but it's not all. And that's such an important point to make, even though it kind of shouldn't be, right? But it is, because people just go, oh, well, it's just a bunch of Muslims and I'm not one and I don't even know any. And so what the hell do I care, kind of a thing. But in fact, they do this kind of thing to white people, too. They do this to right wing you know, the Hutteri militia and all this kind of nonsense that they try to entrap and set up. And they do the same thing to Earth Firster type left wingers all the time, including all the enhancements and special administrative measures that you mentioned and all that, right?
Well, the terrorism enhancement would apply for any crime of terror, any terrorism offense. And
but that could mean lighting a Ford Expedition on fire at a parking lot because you're a hippie, kind of a thing that they try to blow up into an Al-Qaeda attack.
If they frame it as a terrorism-related offense, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we focused in this report on cases involving the American Muslim community precisely because it's having this very profound impact on community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the American people in general should be upset that this is what the FBI is using its resources for. You know, 40% of the FBI's budget now is supposed to go to counterterrorism. And they've adopted this approach that they say is preventive. But in fact, it's really, in many cases, the FBI going into communities on fishing expeditions, finding someone who's vulnerable, who's mentally ill or very young, and basically turning them into would-be terrorists.
Mm-hmm. Well, and meanwhile, real attacks like Detroit, Times Square, Boston happen right under their nose because they're too busy trapping some idiot into, oh, yeah, you're going to take down the Brooklyn Bridge with a blowtorch, kid. Say you love Osama, yeah. I'll give you $20,000.
Yeah, you could ask a lot of questions about it. I mean, is the FBI properly spending that many resources on counterterrorism as opposed to other sorts of crimes that are being committed, corporate crimes, for example? And then even within counterterrorism, why on earth are they trying to build cases against these people who, under no imaginable circumstances, would they even be capable or competent of carrying out these crimes on their own, much less have the resources to mm-hmm. do so, if it hadn't been for the FBI?
Yeah. Well, and I think it is the way Trevor Aronson counted up is about 50 of them were the outright entrapments. And the worst one to me was Hamid Hayat, because I guess just he was the youngest, the kid in Lodi, California, who the FBI put the words in his mouth that his grandfather's training Al-Qaeda in his basement in pole vaulting techniques for, I guess, Al-Qaeda's role in the upcoming Olympic Games at the time, or whatever it was the FBI agent was fantasizing about when he put those words in the kid's mouth. And the jury went ahead and put him in prison 25 to life over such nonsense, such outright nonsense.
Yeah, one of the cases that I find most disturbing is the one of Rezwan Firdaus, who was a young man who was the FBI agents recognized from the beginning mentally unwell. And they decided to send an informant after him, and his mental condition deteriorated throughout his entire time talking to the FBI, to the point that he was wearing diapers and his father had to quit his job to take care of him. Yet they continued to push him forward towards, you know, carrying out some kind of action that the FBI itself was funding and, you know, they themselves hashed the plot for.
I'm sorry, which city was that in? That's how I memorize these, is by
That's
the town.
That's in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I don't even know that one.
Yeah, and then there's another case that is actually going to be the focus of an HBO documentary this evening, which is the case of the Newburgh Four in Newburgh, New York. Uh-huh. And that case involved four men who were poor. They were indigent. One of them was approached by an informant who had just been hanging out at the local Newburgh Mosque for no reason we can make any sense of. And, you know, he just lost his job at Walmart, and he was this guy who, you know, the judge described him as a buffoon.
I'm sorry. I have to interrupt you here, Marie. We got to take this break, but when we get back, we'll pick up with that story of the buffoon's entrapment at the hands of some other buffoons at the FBI.
Okay,
here.
Thank you.
Maria McFarland from HRW, HRW.org. One sec, y'all. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys. Well, so she had to go. That was Maria McFarland from Human Rights Watch. These things hurt my ears, man. Stick with the monitors. Maria McFarland from Human Rights Watch. U.S. terrorism prosecution is often an illusion. I guess we weren't really clear in the email about how long she could stay, so she emailed me and she had to go. I wish I'd known when I only had 10 minutes, I would have interrupted her more and focused more on, man, I wanted to, god dang it, didn't I say at the beginning, I want to focus away from the entrapments and focus more on the other stuff, the material support. That's what I really wanted to get back to. What's material support? Anything. How can they have locked up 500 terrorism prosecutions? One small handful of very pseudo-Al-Qaeda dudes, starting with Musawi, since then. But 500 cases? That's defining terrorism down big time. Not just the 50 entrapments. The 450. What the hell's going on there? That's what I wanted to ask her about. You know what? I'm going to see if maybe I can get her, the other lady who wrote it, Andrea something, back on the show tomorrow. Or I don't know, maybe I'll interview the other Scott Horton or somebody, damn it. That was what I wanted to ask about, more than anything. I didn't ask it well, that's why it didn't work out. That should have just been my first question. Forget the entrapments, we know about that, let's talk about this other stuff. But see, I suck at radio. I'm interested, I'm just no good at it. Maybe I should try writing again. I got burned out on writing. I'm just not patient enough. This is easier. Anyway, Human Rights Watch. Terrorism prosecutions, often an illusion. And it's a 200-page report. The Illusion of Justice. Spencer Ackerman also has a write-up at The Guardian about this. And this is so important to, you know, it's too important to be screwed up by me like it was today. Because here's what it is. 500 bogus cases, that's basically what we're talking about, rounding up slightly. You're talking about complete and total miscarriages of justice here, and not just on the entrapments, but on people who gave to a charity, but they didn't know that that charity knew somebody who knew Hamas one time, or some crap. Look at Jose Padilla. He was their poster boy. John Ashcroft announced from Moscow that there was no law that applied to Jose Padilla. He might be an American-born, American citizen, arrested on American soil at O'Hare Airport in Chicago by FBI agents, presumably in blue parkas and suits and maybe some SWAT gear, but still civilian cops, arrested, legal definition, quote-unquote, but then turned over to Donald Rumsfeld and George Tenet to be tortured. And all based on, oh, he was going to blow up a radioactive dirty bomb, which they tortured out of Binya Mohammed by Cover Your Kids' Ears. 1, 2, 3. Slicing his male parts with razor blades, the CIA did, until Binya Mohammed would make up some lie about Jose Padilla. Oh yeah, he was going to set off a dirty bomb. And they ended up convicting him. And all they convicted him of was knowing a guy who knew a guy who sent some money to Chechnya. And also he talked about soccer on the phone. And you Miami jury idiots are unfamiliar pretty much with that, right? And so if we tell you that we swear that that's a code word for terrorism, you'll go along with that, won't you? You idiots. And the jury agreed that, yes, they are idiots. And they took this innocent man. Well, he'd been palling around with some bad guys. Maybe there was a real charge in there somewhere. I never saw it. They took a guy who was innocent of everything they charged him with, everything they had ever accused him of, after they knew that he'd been held without law for years and tortured in isolation in a CIA, you know, military brig in South Carolina. And they went ahead and convicted him and told the government, yeah, you can continue to hold this guy for the rest of his life. What do we care? Based on nothing. Based on knew a guy who sent some money to the Chechen rebels, who, of course, America supported. Those are the good jihadists who hate the Russians, don't you know? Give me a break, man. Listen, what World War IV Woolsey thinks is what goes, okay? Get it together. Anyway. So this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I know my stuff, but I'm bad at radio. I guess I start, oh, no, I don't, it's too late now. I wasted that whole segment wasted on talking. Human Rights Watch, go read their great report about the, never mind the CIA, and never mind the military, just the FBI and the Department of Justice, just them and their ridiculous, farcical, tragic war, fake war on terrorism since September 11th. Hey, you stupid idiot loser, I'll give you $20,000 if you tell this camera you love Osama. Say it. $20,000. You've never seen $1,000 together in your life. Here's $50,000. I'll give you $50,000 if you say you love Osama. Cuff him. Life in prison for you. Yeah. Over and over again. Bunch of bogus cases. 500 cases. And you hear what she said, too. Abuses at all stages. From the time they arrest you on some bogus charge, on some hugely overinterpreted accusation. They put you in isolation. They put you in special administrative measures, which means you can't talk to your lawyer in private, even. You're completely isolated from your family or anything before trial, even, as she stipulated. Hey, how important is that? Your right to your counsel and to be able to speak with your counsel in private and not have your entire conversation recorded and handed over to those who are prosecuting you. What in the hell is that? And then, of course, the ridiculous sentences, because if somebody says the T word, then she said, away you go. Mandatory minimum, 18, and then the rest is all piled on top of that. So, look at Hamid Hayat. He's doing 25 to life. And I swear, I don't know if the video's there anymore, but for a time, well, the LA Times did some pretty good journalism on it. And they did one story that was their weekend magazine that was like 10,000 words or something, right? They went ahead and actually did their damn job and wrote up a real story about what happened to Hamid Hayat and his father. And they included the video. And the video shows the FBI agent interrogating the kid. Like, you can watch it somewhere. I'm sure it exists online somewhere. Where he's got the kid saying that his grandpa, the FBI agent has the kid saying his grandpa's teaching Al-Qaeda how to pole vault in his basement in Kandahar. They gave him 25 to life. because a rat was able to put words in his mouth that everyone knows weren't true. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm at scotthorton.org. Keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And Eric Margulies coming up to talk about what's going on in the Gaza Strip. And so that means I have half an hour. I really should have started last segment. But anyway, I have half an hour to go through this. Some friends have asked me to comment on this. And I'll just say a few things before I get started with the audio here. It's Dennis Prager making the case for Israel. And the first thing about it is that I'm really not an expert on Israel-Palestine. I know a lot about the politics of it here. But the point is, you don't have to be to debunk this crap. Anybody who takes an honest assessment of the situation whatsoever will be able to raise any of the objections I'm about to raise themselves, and they're all argument-shattering ones. And so, I guess, you know, believe me now, hear it in a minute. I don't claim to be the world's expert on this the way Prager does, but I can still correct him. And then the other thing is, and you heard Ray mention this earlier, it's just like you see on Perry Mason, or God forbid, if the state gets their grubby mitts on you and you end up in court, you're sworn under oath, if you testify, to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, because a lot of partial truths can amount, or even one partial truth can amount to a gigantic lie if all important details are left out. So, no excuses. You gotta provide all the context that, you know, determines whether your conclusions are right or not. Otherwise, it's not a fair argument. It's outside the rules of argument. So, the rules of evidence. So, you know, I'm not perfect, but I try to incorporate the best of my opponent's arguments on my show as best I can all the time. You know, in order, hell, that's the only way I can be right, is if I make sure to change my mind as soon as I find out I was wrong. I got to try to find out I'm wrong all the time in case there's a problem. It's kind of my job, so I think that's how we should all take these kind of questions up. Anyway, again, right now, 532 Palestinians dead, 20 of them, 20 Israelis dead. 80% of the Palestinians are civilians. 94% of the dead Israelis are soldiers, including two Americans, which maybe I'll have time to get to that point later on. But anyway, first of all, here is this Dennis Prager flash animation video going around all about explaining the case for Israel, basically. And apparently this is about a year old, and it's making the rounds again in your conservative father's email account. So here we go.
Easiest conflict in the world to explain. It may be the hardest to solve, but it is the easiest to explain. In a nutshell, it's this. One side wants the other side dead. Israel wants to exist as a Jewish state and to live in peace. Israel also recognizes the right of Palestinians to have their own state and to live in peace.
All right, so there's so many assertions in here. I think I have to stop and go through them kind of one at a time. You notice what all he's skipping there is World War II and Zionism and the foundation of Israel and how the hell they even got here at all. It's simply just one side is, I guess, possessed by evil. And so, therefore, they're just determined to never compromise. They only want to kill the other side. And if anyone wanted to say, to make an argument in this about, oh, one side simply wants the others, this or that, the answer is one side wants the other's land. And they've been taking it, and they're still taking it. And apparently they're willing to kill a hell of a lot of them to continue taking it. But all that is just completely left out. All you need to know about Israel is they just want peace. Accept that as premise number one of this entire argument and forget anything about how we got here, at least for now, at least while we get you on Israel's side.
The problem, however, is that most Palestinians and many other Muslims and Arabs do not recognize the right of the Jewish state of Israel to exist.
Oh, yeah, see, and then he ended. See, I already let him go on too long before I stopped him. He ended by saying, and Israel's totally for the two-state solution. They've always said there should be a Palestinian state. It's just that the Palestinians refuse to recognize the right of Israel to exist, he claims.
This has been true since 1947, when the United Nations voted to divide the land called Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab state.
All right, now, it's just not true. In fact, all the Arab states in the region recognize Israel and their right to exist, including the Palestinian Authority since 1988 or 89, and including Hamas since at least 2006. I've seen Hamas on the Charlie Rose Show saying, of course, and we've said it again and again and again, we'll recognize Israel's right to exist within 67 borders. We're just saying end the occupations of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. They're not just saying that, but they're not saying Israel has to stop existing. That is not part of Hamas's demands, even Hamas's demands. But meanwhile, all of the Gulf states and Egypt and Jordan are friends with Israel. So it's just not true.
The Jews accepted the United Nations partition, but no Arab or any other Muslim country accepted it. When British rule ended on May 15, 1948, the armies of all the neighboring Arab states, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Transjordan, and Egypt, attacked the one-day-old state of Israel in order to destroy it.
Right, because they are evil and hate Jews, I guess. Except, of course, what he leaves out is that the Israelis weren't abiding by the UN partition plan whatsoever. They changed the demographics on the ground from 56% of the land to 78% of the land. And before the invasion, it had been 9 months since the UN mandate, and there had been civil war that whole time. And 750,000 Arabs were turned into refugees. They were forced out in what's known as the Nakba. Now, Dennis Prager can just completely leave that out. He doesn't address it, and so you're left to just, I guess, presume that it's a land without people. There are no other reasons that the neighboring states attacked other than the British left, and so they had their chance to kill all the Jews because they just lived to kill Jews, I guess. He doesn't say, but you're left, again, to infer, to presume, because he doesn't say there'd been a war going on for the better part of a year, and the Palestinians were being massacred and completely uprooted, and almost a million of them were turned into refugees. And now, that doesn't mean that the leaders of all the Arab states were a bunch of angels at the time. Again, we're talking 1948. And that war, the British sock puppet Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan had its own interest for wanting to take the West Bank, for example. But for Prager to just pretend that there is nothing that happened on the Israeli side, that they had not done anything to anyone, the UN partition plan that he just mentioned, he doesn't need to go back and talk about how the Israelis refused to abide by it themselves from the very beginning and were simply engaged in ethnic cleansing of the people of Palestine. But nope, they just invaded for no reason because they're jerks.
But to the world's surprise, the little Jewish state survived.
Plucky little guys.
Then it happened again. In 1967, the dictator of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser, announced his plan, in his words, to destroy Israel. He placed Egyptian troops on Israel's border and armies of surrounding Arab countries were also mobilized to attack.
All right, now we have to stop and go to this break. When we get back, I'll proceed with the debunking of Dennis Prager's pro-Israel propaganda video.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for the Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, the Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, the Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's the Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Again, I got some tweets saying, hey, Scott, would you go over some of this? It's a video of Dennis Prager at LiveLeak.com, the Israel-Arab conflict on one foot. It's called... It's quite simple, you see, when you leave out entirely the other side of the story. Quite simple. So he's talking about the 1967 war. Everybody was poised to attack, but Israel attacked first. Here, I guess I'll let him finish. I had to hit pause at everyone was ready to attack Israel.
However, Israel preemptively attacked Egypt and Syria. Israel did not attack Jordan and begged Jordan's king not to join the war. But he did. And only because of that did Israel take control of Jordanian land, specifically the West Bank of the Jordan River.
All right, now, I got to admit, I don't know about the detail about the Jordanian king at that point. But I do know that I'll refer you to Murray Rothbard, War Guilt in the Middle East, that he wrote in the summer of 1967 about the 67 war and how Israel started it. And so if you want a much broader context of what was going on there, you know, someone asked me on Twitter, hey, can you tell me about the 67 war? You know, let me see. What's probably the best thing to do? Oh, I know. I'll put in Murray Rothbard, 67 war, and see what I find. Blam. So there you go, of course. But then more important than Rothbard is this primary source. This is a speech by Menachem Begin, the former prime minister of Israel, and... it's from the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs website. No lie, you can look it up yourself, pick a few choice words I say and Google them, and you'll find it at mfa.gov.il. It is the website of the Israel Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Menachem Begin says, in June 1967, we again had a choice. He's talking about wars of choice, various ones. Previously... he's talking about the Sinai Peninsula one. Ike Eisenhower and the Suez Canal crisis with the British and the French. All right, in June 67, we again had a choice. The Egyptian army concentrations in the Sinai approaches do not prove, said Begin, that Nasser really was about to attack us. We must be honest with ourselves. Not anybody else, I guess. We decided to attack him. This was a war of self-defense in the noblest sense of the term. The government of national unity then established decided unanimously, we will take the initiative and attack the enemy, drive him back, and thus assure the security of Israel and the future of the nation. We did not do this for lack of an alternative. We could have gone on waiting. We could have sent the army home. Who knows if there would have been an attack against us? There is no proof of it. There are several arguments to the contrary. While it is indeed true that the closing of the Straits of Tehran was an act of aggression, a casus belli, there is always room for a great deal of consideration as to whether it is necessary to make a casus into a bellum. And then so he continues. And so there were three wars with no alternative from his point of view. The War of Independence, the War of Attrition, and the Yom Kippur War.
It is our misfortune that our wars have been so. In the other two wars, the Wars of Choice, the Sinai Campaign, and the Six-Day War, we had losses like those in the new... Again, those are the Wars of Choice, according even to Menachem Begin. Quite contra Dennis Prager here.
Shortly after the war, the Arab states went to Khartoum, Sudan, and announced their famous three no's.
Oh yeah, see, here's the other thing. He says, oh yeah, and only because Jordan intervened did Israel take the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Okay, maybe, but still, that was in 1967. And he just lets it, he just, you know, as though your brain can't come up with the question yourself. But yeah, what about since then? They get to occupy it forever now? They won it in a war, and then so what? They get to just hold the people there as prisoners forever, and their children and their grandchildren. Really? It's a very simple case when you just leave out all the details.
No recognition, no peace, and no negotiations. What was Israel supposed to do?
Even still, well, he's one only thing talking Israel about the mid-1970s, and I'm sure that ain't the whole story of then, but again, I'm not the expert. But even then, that position all changed by the end of the 1970s.
More than a decade later, in 1978, was to give the entire Sinai Peninsula an area of land bigger than Israel itself and with oil back to Egypt because Egypt, under new leadership, signed a peace agreement with Israel. So Israel gave land for the promise of peace with Egypt, and it has always been willing to do the same thing with the Palestinians.
So, first of all, on the Egypt thing, that was the Camp David deal, where America agreed to pay them both $3 billion a year forever and protect the Egyptian military dictatorship forever in order to bribe it into not attacking Israel. And then, obviously, the Israelis didn't really want the Sinai, or they wouldn't have given it up. They gave it up under American pressure, but, it clearly was not a priority of theirs. He makes it sound like it's some gigantic sacrifice of them. And I don't know how much oil is there, but look at the way they treat the Gazans now because they want that natural gas so bad. So don't tell me how altruistic the Israelis are when it comes to giving up resources because they just desire peace so badly. And of course, American support for the military dictatorship in Egypt in order to keep the peace between Egypt and Israel is a big part of the motivating factor for the September 11th hijackers and Egyptian Islamic Jihad, which merged with bin Laden and the Azzam group to create al-Qaeda in the first place. Of course, all the lead hijackers were from Cairo, and that's what they were about. Was hating their dictatorship and hating Israel and hating America for supporting them both. So, not that Israel's part of America or anything. So as long as, there are no consequences for Americans that we ever have to consider here, including how much it is to pay both of these countries $3 billion a year to not go to war with each other with all the weapons we've given them both, then I guess it's all fine. But otherwise, we have to start tallying the costs like September 11th and its aftermath.
All the Palestinians have ever had to do is recognize Israel as a Jewish state and promise to live in peace with it.
Okay, now see, that's just a damn lie. And of course, the way he works in the Jewish state thing there is to obscure the fact that Yasser Arafat and his guys, again, said that they were willing to recognize Israel within 67 borders, that is, give up the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, but otherwise, back in 1988. And Hamas has been willing to recognize Israel's right to exist at least since 2006, and they've said so repeatedly. And they say, oh, no, it's in their founding charter or whatever, that Israel must be destroyed or whatever. Well, it's in the Likud party's founding charter that all of the West Bank is Judea and Samaria and belongs to Israel, and that they'll never have a Palestinian state there, that they'll all have to go eventually. And in fact, Netanyahu's coalition is with people far to the right of him who would outright annex all the West Bank and expel the Palestinians and have said so. Anyway, sorry, I'm short on time.
But when Israel has proposed trading land for peace,
and then they work in the Jewish state part because they know that's a deal breaker because there's so many Palestinian Muslims, Arab Muslims that are Israeli citizens that already have second, third class Jim Crow status. And I'm not even talking about the occupied. I'm talking about within Israel proper, that they're saying that the people of the West Bank would have to go ahead and endorse that situation. When it's completely a red herring, and it's a brand new one, relatively speaking, just in the last few years under Benjamin Netanyahu, that now you have to talk about just how Jewish the state is, too. Because, you know, all their demands all this time, that the Palestinians have accepted all this time, not good enough. Got to keep moving those goalposts, always.
1,000, when it agreed to give the Palestinians a sovereign state in more than 95% of the West Bank.
See, that's a lie, and you can read Robert Malley, who worked for Bill Clinton during those negotiations, who wrote in the New York Review of Books all about how the American side was working for Israel the whole time. The offer that Arafat supposedly couldn't refuse but did anyway was actually absolutely horrible and had the West Bank divided up into tiny little Bantu stands like it is now forever. And Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister and then prime minister, Barak, but anyway... 2000. Anyway, Netanyahu's on tape talking about how he screwed Bill Clinton and how he just defined Area C. Oh, man. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. All right, so I went ahead and bumped Eric Margulies 15 minutes so I can try to finish this up for you here. I'm sorry for taking so long. I'm going over this viral video of Dennis Prager stating Israel's case. Which is fine, but it would have been nice if he had acknowledged that the Palestinians even exist throughout this entire thing, or, you know, any kind of honest way. Anyway, so I'm trying to deconstruct it a little bit for you here. And where I ended up was this scam that, oh yeah, as everybody knows, and conventional wisdom, as everyone knows, is always wrong. So you could start with that. Oh, the Israelis were willing to give up the whole West Bank, 95%. To Yasser Arafat and the Palestinians, but no, not good enough for them. They would rather sabotage and destroy the whole thing. Where, well, that's completely undermined by the writings of Robert Malley in the New York Review of Books about America's position and Israel's positions in those negotiations and what really happened, as well as the video that some settlers took of Netanyahu that they published on YouTube. Of Netanyahu talking about how he screwed Bill Clinton and about how he told Bill Clinton one thing while he was doing another. Oh, yeah, all we need is a little bit of, you know, a little Area C here and a little Area B there. And what he really meant was the Israelis will never, ever leave the Gaza Strip's eastern border. The Jordan River Valley must belong to Israel forever. And by the way, all the settlements in the West Bank stay, and all the walls and all the Bantu stands and all that stay, and it's nothing like a Palestinian state ever. Just like Netanyahu, when he's lying and saying he wants a Palestinian state, he describes it as something that's not a state at all. Only when he's being candid and he doesn't know he's being recorded, he's laughing about it. And he says that he was warned to not provoke the Americans this way. And play Bill Clinton the way he was doing it. And he said, you know, he's quoting himself, his response is, don't worry about the Americans. 80% of them support us. It's absurd. Oh, no, I missed a part. Don't worry about the Americans. They are easily moved. 80% of them support us. It's absurd, Netanyahu said. He can get away with anything. Don't worry about that. And, oh, you want a narrative? Here's a simple little narrative. Israel tried to make a deal, but Arafat just wouldn't take it. Isn't that easy to memorize and repeat? Doesn't matter if it's true or not.
And all of Gaza? The Palestinian leadership rejected the offer and instead responded by sending waves of suicide terrorists into Israel.
Right, and no mention of Ariel Sharon deliberately going to the Temple Mount and deliberately provoking, for his own domestic political reasons, the Second Intifada.
Meanwhile, Palestinian radio, television, and school curricula remain...
Well, and no, you know what? And no mention of the fact that, okay, yes, right, if he was being the slightest bit honest here, okay, yes, the Palestinian people of the West Bank and East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip, they have been under a foreign government's occupation this whole time, but it's still all Arafat's fault or something, right? But the Palestinians still here are just invisible. That there are people here who, for longer than the Soviet Union occupied Eastern Europe, they have been occupied by the Israeli military and National Police Force.
Filled with glorification of terrorists, demonization of Jews, and the daily repeated message that Israel should cease to exist.
Right. Just like in Israel, where they celebrate militarism endlessly and have conscription, demonize Muslims and chant death to the Arabs in the streets and act like Muslims and Arabs have no rights, aren't really human. And therefore, if we want what they have, we can kill them and take it. Oh, because, oh, boo-hoo, poor us, the people that we're occupying and imprisoning are resisting, so we're the victims. Because that's what terrorists they are, that even when they're completely subjugated, they still try to fight back. Why won't they stop? And then, Israel can exist. Standing in for get out of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem.
So it's not hard to explain the Middle East dispute. One side wants the other dead.
One side wants the other's land.
The motto of Hamas...
And are steadily colonizing on it. They're massive colonies the size of towns on the West Bank. They monopolize all the water resources. And, some of them are the size of towns that it's pretty hard to imagine them ever going away. You're talking about colonies on other people's land.
The Palestinian rulers of Gaza is, we love death as much as the Jews love life.
Oh, that may be true, but so what? That doesn't mean anything. That in the most desperate circumstances, the most right-wing reactionary religious militia comes to the fore in the Gaza Strip prison. So? When everybody knows that their job is controlling the people of the Gaza Strip for Israel. Hamas is a tool, at least in effect, of the Israelis as much as the Palestinian Authority on the West Bank is. And yes, it's true. You can read Andrew Higgins in the Wall Street Journal, and you can read Richard Sale in UPI all about how the Israeli government encouraged the rise of Hamas as a right-wing religious alternative to the PLO to help split Palestinian power between right and left and between Gaza and Palestine, just as they, at least in effect, engineered the election of Gaza back in 2006 by withholding all the tax revenue from Fatah and the Palestinian Authority, the Arafatites, so they couldn't buy all the votes that they needed to win.
There are 22 Arab states in the world, stretching from the Atlantic Ocean to the Indian Ocean. There is one Jewish state in the world, and it is about the size of New Jersey.
And at this part of the video, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, they're colored in all the way blue. Greater Israel. That is Israel. It ain't occupied territory. It ain't disputed territory. It's Israel, says Dennis Prager. And because some Arabs live in other countries, then that means the Israeli Jews can kick all of the Palestinian Muslims out of Palestine, their country, the Palestinians' country. Right? You see how that doesn't make any sense at all. But it's stated with such confidence and ease that, hey, yeah, why can't all the people from Gaza just go move to Iraq or, you know, kill themselves if they're in Israel's way, right?
In fact, tiny El Salvador is larger than Israel. Finally, think about these two questions. If tomorrow Israel laid down its arms and announced, "We will fight no more," what would happen? And if the Arab countries around Israel laid down their arms and announced, "We will fight no more," what would happen? In the first case, there would be an immediate destruction of the state of Israel and mass murder of its Jewish population. In the second case, there would be peace the next day.
Oh, God. What a joke. Well, you know, your flash animation of your little peace dove really convinces me. Except that no one is saying, no one, not even Hamas, is saying that all the Israeli Jews have to die or go jump in the Mediterranean Sea and never come back. Not even Hamas. Nor the dictatorship of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Oman, Yemen, Jordan, Egypt. None of them are saying that. Nor is the Palestinian Authority on the West Bank. And no one is saying that all Israeli Jews must disarm and become complete and total pacifists and let themselves all be murdered. At the hands of which foreign armies are supposedly coming for him now again? What a joke. And again, all just a red herring. All a stand-in for the occupation and subjugation and torture and murder of the occupied Palestinians of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. That's pretty much the deal. Eric Margolies on what's going on in Gaza now, next.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and our next guest is Eric Margolies. He's the author of War at the Top of the World, and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. And he's the author of this recent piece. We're running it in the views at antiwar.com today. David V. Goliath in Gaza. Some more of this poor little Israel claptrap, huh? Welcome back to the show, Eric. How are you doing?
Thank you, Scott. Well, I'm watching these multiple stories. With first Gaza, the disaster there, the man-made disaster there, the crash in Ukraine. Very, very dismaying time.
Yeah, things are looking pretty bad here. Well, so now, I just went over this piece of right-wing pro-Israel propaganda that was going around, and I was trying to kind of debunk it. It was Dennis Prager kind of leaving out more than half the story and telling the story about Israel as David and all of the surrounding Arabs as Goliath. I guess in a general sense, can you comment about that, of just who's the underdog and who's not?
We've heard this for many times. Poor little Israel, the base facing 100 million Arabs. The reality is that the Arab states are all incompetent messes right now. They have almost zero military capability. Half of them are allied with Israel secretly, like Egypt and Saudi Arabia and some of the Gulf sheikhdoms, Jordan. They've long been covert Israeli allies. So really, the Palestinians who are trying to establish their own state have almost no backers left. They have Syria, which is in chaos and being torn apart by a U.S.-led revolution, and distant Iran, Hezbollah.
And Hamas has sided with the rebels against Hezbollah and Assad up there in Lebanon, so that's it for Syrian support for them, right?
I know. It's a very dismal situation. So much for Arab Brotherhood. But the real point is that Hamas all happens to be the only, after Tunisia, the only other democratically elected government in the Arab world. that's left. And it is now being crushed by the Israelis, not so much because it's firing rockets, which, as I wrote it, I think is very foolish, but because they want to crush any resistance to Israel's control in the area, and they want to put an end to any hope for a Palestinian state.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I guess I've heard them say, and it's pretty clear, right, that this, I mean, they weren't even shy about it at all. Netanyahu denounced America for recognizing the coalition Fatah-Hamas government there. And so everybody says, yeah, this is meant to undermine that, to destroy that alliance. And maybe it already has. I don't know. Maybe Hamas has withdrawn from it. But I guess I don't really see the, you know, the 1-2 there, how exactly that's supposed to work. It seems like, if anything, it would just motivate the Palestinians to, in defiance, to try to keep that coalition government together. When, you know, anybody on the West Bank, just as well as the other 7 billion of us on Earth, know that Hamas didn't kidnap those kids and start this whole trouble. So why wouldn't Fatah side with Hamas rather than with what the Israelis want them to do?
Because Fatah, after the murder of Yasser Arafat, or what looks like a murder anyway, Fatah has become a puppet, a sock puppet for the Americans and the Israelis. They paid for it. They bribe all the Fatah leaders. They control its security forces. They provide it with food. And Mahmoud Abbas, the Fatah leader, is really a disgraceful person. A quisling, but even him, he's making little peeps of protest, but he's viewed by most of the Palestinians as a traitor.
Well, the headline at antiwar.com is now 556 Palestinians killed, 27 Israelis killed, and last I heard, when it was 20 of them, 18 of them were soldiers. And, you know, Eric, I want to go ahead and bring this up because I'm sure you'll have something smart to say about it. Two of these Israeli soldiers killed were Americans, one from California, one from Texas, over there fighting for Israel. They've got a birthright that the Palestinian refugees of the Gaza Strip do not. What's up with that?
Well, America has long allowed joint Israeli-American citizenship before any joint citizens were allowed. The Israelis got a special dispensation, and in fact, a lot of Israelis hold joint citizenship. If I went and served in the Egyptian armed forces, I could lose my American citizenship, but there's carte blanche to do whatever you want in Israel. Israel gets away with whatever it wants in the U.S. government because it controls Congress, or at least congressional affairs on the Middle East, and this is a special exemption. What's more important in this case is that certainly the whole Arab world and much of the rest of the world is viewing the agony of Palestine and blaming it on the United States. They say America's doing it. It's being done with American weapons in violation of America's own laws, the Arms Export Control Act, and that America's financing Israel, and that America could push a button and stop Israel in a minute if it had the political will. So really the blame for this bloodbath sits as much with the U.S. as it does with Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I saw Barack Obama today saying that he wants a ceasefire, and he's sending Kerry over there to get a ceasefire. But what he might as well have said is, well, of course, I could have called for a ceasefire all along, but only now am I deciding to, and I'm going to do it by sending Kerry not to Tel Aviv to read him the riot act, or to Jerusalem to read him the riot act. I'm going to send him to Cairo, where the al-Sisi dictatorship has already proven that they have no real interest in brokering some kind of deal with Hamas, or not a deal that they could possibly accept anyway.
That's quite right. Egypt, as I said, all the years under Mubarak was a secret Israeli ally, and now it's just right out in the open. This tin pot dictator al-Sisi hates and fears Hamas as much as the Israelis do and is collaborating with them to squeeze it to death by shutting off the border crossing from Egypt into Gaza. And he worked with the Israelis to try and create a fake ceasefire agreement in which the Palestinians weren't even consulted. So, you know, I remember the days, 1956, when the Israelis invaded Sinai and tried to grab it for themselves. And our last great independent president, Dwight Eisenhower, told the Israelis, get out or else. And the Israelis got and gave up Sinai. Today you have feeble President Obama.
Yeah.
Who says, well, we should be negotiating.
All right. No, we're gonna pick that up. Obama's responsibility, right on the other side of this break. It's maybe the most important point of all here, aside from the casualties. It's the great Eric Margolies, author of American Raj, ericmargolies.com. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Eric Margolies about Israel's slaughter of Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip. This big trumped-up crisis. Everybody knows that Netanyahu is lying like John Kerry, talking about, oh, we know Hamas kidnapped these kids. He just wanted an excuse to go to war against Gaza. But anyway, we were talking about the president's responsibility, and you brought up Dwight Eisenhower and how when he got on the phone, the Israelis came to heel. How mad would Barack Obama have to get Benjamin Netanyahu to stop doing what he wants to do in the Gaza Strip, Eric?
Well, the president has the power to do it, but he doesn't have the will. You know, elections are now on the horizon. The Democrats are worried. Republicans are beating the war drums. So typically, the minute elections appear on the radar scope, the Israelis get away with whatever they want to do. And that's exactly what's happening. You know, Netanyahu was, well, what he was really afraid of was that an independent Palestinian state on the West Bank had become a step closer after the Hamas PLO accord. And this is his way of breaking it. I think he's done it very successfully with this attack on Gaza.
Mm-hmm. And yet the two-state thing was already dead. That's what everybody said when Kerry's ridiculous joke of a half-hearted attempt fell apart. It came to an end. Everyone said, well, so that's it for two states. Now what are we going to do kind of thing, right? So, I mean, what was he even afraid of from this coalition government? I don't get it.
You know, he was afraid that it at least presented a viable path. Because remember, Hamas has been demonized by the United States and by Israel as a terrorist organization. We will never do business with terrorists. That's mantra one. Israel has the right to defend itself, mantra number two. And so as long as they could claim that beat the terrorism drums, they could avoid dealing with Hamas, which, by the way, was partially created by the Israelis way back when. But the linking to Hamas to the more kosher PLO government, which is controlled by the U.S. and Israel, as I said, made it more acceptable as a partner and raised the threat that the U.S. might come back and push for some kind of Palestinian state. Well, it's really not going to happen now, but what Prime Minister Netanyahu has done is ensured another decade of searing hatred between Arabs and Jews in the region.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was wondering if maybe it had something to do with their joining UN organizations as kind of that whole General Assembly route to statehood that they kind of sort of started on. It seemed like mostly as a bargaining chip. But I guess the Abbas government was doing that without any kind of alliance with Hamas at the time anyway, right?
That's correct. And it was really the Hamas, the Abbas government was taking orders from the U.S. and from Israel. So that wasn't a big threat. I think what's more of a threat for Israel is the spreading worldwide disinvestment movement in Israel. It's spreading through academia and liberal left circles. There's great anger at Israel. Even amongst many American Jews are very unhappy with what Israel is doing. It's lurched to the far right, is seen as antithetical to everything that the Jewish people stand for. And so this is Netanyahu's way of fighting back. And he has derailed any peace process. And he's given his settlers, because this is really the settlers' movement that's doing this, he's given them more time to gobble up what's left of the West Bank.
Right. And so, well, I want to get back to that in a second to ask you about the future, what you think is going to keep happening in both of these occupied territories. But could you go back to what you said about Israel helping to create Hamas and elaborate a little bit there? I know I can add two footnotes, and that's Richard Sale in UPI and Andrew Higgins in the Wall Street Journal, both of whom people can Google about this subject.
Yes, back in the, I think it was in the late 70s, but don't pin me down on the date. Exactly, Hamas sprang up as a religious welfare movement and to provide schools and education and food and social welfare for the Palestinian people. It was loosely linked to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which was a social movement. The Israelis saw this and they saw what a great way of splitting the Palestinian people, and they allowed Hamas to grow and even at least close their eyes, if not encourage, the flow of funding to Hamas, which allowed it to develop very quickly and to become an important social movement amongst Palestinians. Now the Israelis are kicking themselves for doing this. Well, the leader of Hamas, Sheikh Yassin, very respected man, crippled in a wheelchair, he was very anti-Israeli, but at some point he called, and I saw the speech, he called for living with Israel, a peaceful resolution with Israel. Shortly after that, he was assassinated by the Israelis.
Oh, man. And you know what? See, I didn't realize that was really what had preceded. And you certainly sound convinced that that was the motive for killing him.
That's a supposition on my part.
Sounds like a fair one. Well, and you know, this is the point where Ray McGovern always picks up and says, and of course, the assassination with that missile of Yassin, the old man in the wheelchair, the founder of Hamas, is what helped lead to the lynching of the Fallujah, the Blackwater Guards in Fallujah. And then that was, of course, led to a whole other chain of dominoes falling down in the Iraq War and sectarian cleansing back and forth and death squads lining up against each other, etc. Came from that original sin in a way. Not that everything was going fine with the occupation before that necessarily, but that is in fact how it played out. It was riots, and the Al-Yassin Brigade, they called themselves or whatever, were the ones who killed the Blackwater Guards.
Good memory there.
Yeah, well, it's Ray McGovern. Right. I'm relying on him. He's a smart guy too. That's the advantage of being a radio host. I get to talk to all of you guys who know everything, and so I remember as much as I can. Without ever having to actually go to Gaza and risk dying myself, which is what a lot of people in Gaza are doing right now, including a lot of reporters, apparently.
In the last few days, Scott, the Israelis who claim to be doing targeted reprisals on Gaza to knock out missile sites are using 155-millimeter self-propelled gun supplied by the United States to shell residential areas from long distance. This is not even line of sight. It's, you know, at a distance. They use the air spotters or on the ground. It is very crude. It's like firing heavy artillery down Madison Avenue in New York.
Well, it sort of seems like, I mean, I don't know what kind of ceasefire they'll get, but I guess my bet would be it'd be just like in 09 and just like in 2012, where they just sort of back off, and then they do this again, mowing the lawn, they call it. And so it'll just be status quo from now on, or what's going to happen here?
This will eventually end with a ceasefire, probably after some spectacular horror. I mean, we're seeing now entire Palestinian families being wiped out.
Yeah, I mean, I've got footage here on my Twitter feed of streets littered with bodies, Eric.
I've been watching the pictures of those Palestinian bodies lying in the streets that appear on European television, but not on American.
That's really something else. And it really does come back to the responsibility of the Americans for the money, for the support in the UN, all the weaponry involved, as you say. And it's just a shame that Americans don't get a chance to hear your side of the story on cable TV yet. Or
yet.
Now. Anyway, thanks very much, Eric. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
The great Eric Margolies, everybody. EricMargolies.com, spelled like Margolis.
Hey, I'll Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And hell, life's still green. Eric, you there? You still there? All right, now that's just a quirk of the phone line.
I thought so.
Yeah, just making sure. I was going to go ahead and ask him about Ukraine then. I don't know. Anyway, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Thanks very much, everybody, for tuning in. And I want to point you guys to this great article on the blog at antiwar.com, antiwar.com/blog. Pretty easy to get to, huh? On Human Shielding in Gaza by Neve Gordon and Nicola Perugini. Anyway, Neve Gordon. And hey, here's what it's about. You see in these pictures that the Israelis are putting out where, it's these propaganda cartoons basically saying, look at evil Hamas hides their weapons behind children. On the face of it, that's what they're saying. But what are they really saying? What they're saying is, hey, civilian homes are up for grabs. Hamas has put them on the target list. It's all their fault, to be sure. But we can bomb your houses now. If we're looking for one guy from Islamic Jihad or from the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade or something, and he happens to be with his entire family, and in the Middle East, among the Arabs anyway, entire family means, no, really, entire family. Aunts and uncles and cousins and grandparents. Then, yeah, well, whatever. They live in basically a giant refugee camp? Oh, well, whatever. The fighters amongst them are hiding behind them when they're all civilians. Basically, what makes a militant? Someone who dares to resist. A male who dares to resist. His life is absolutely forfeit. Oh, and anyone around him, too. Oh, okay. Because, after all, the cartoon swears that Hamas hides their weapons in, the basement. I mean, what are they going to do? They have to level the whole damn house to get all the way down to the basement, right, guys? Or the first floor when the children are on the third? Oh, well. And even in the cartoons, they show a little kid in the house. Well, of course, Hamas, that's how cruel they are to hide behind a kid. What they're really saying is, that's why we kill kids. They're standing on top of a bunch of Hamas rockets. What do you expect us to do? Not kill them? All there in neat little tweet form for you there. Doesn't have to be very sophisticated propaganda to work. A lot of times, the simpler the better. Classical conditioning can be a lot more effective than operant conditioning. You know, you just gotta sing at the right pitch, that's all, I guess. Alright, here, man, I want to play this clip. I wasn't going to play it, because I don't know, man, I don't want to sound patronizing or anything, but I think it's really cool, dude. What the hell, it's James Garner, and he's dead, and I'm going to honor him by playing this clip. It's from It's the Americanization of Emily. It's a great anti-war movie, one of the great anti-war movies, and James Garner plays an officer who is trying not to do combat, and he's with his girlfriend, and he's at his girlfriend's mom's house. He's stationed in England over there just before D-Day, if I remember it right, and the mom is waxing on about how, yeah, later on we'll find out we didn't even have to have this war. It was Churchill who called it the unnecessary war, so what does that tell you? But anyway, and it's all their fault. But my boy still died bravely or something like that. And so James Garner chimes in to correct her a bit. And it's a lot of fun and it's only 3 minutes. So here, listen up. It's James Garner. Rip Rockford. James Garner from The Americanization of Emily.
After every war, you know, we always find out how unnecessary it was. And after this one, I'm sure all the generals will dash off and write books about the blunders made by other generals, and statesmen will publish their secret diaries, and it'll show beyond any shadow of doubt that war could easily have been avoided in the first place. And the rest of us, of course, will be left with the job of bandaging the wounded and burying the dead.
I don't trust people who make bitter reflections about war, Mrs. Barham. It's always the generals with the bloodiest records who are the first to shout what a hell it is. It's always the war widows who lead the Memorial Day parades.
That was unkind, Charlie, and very rude.
We shall never end wars, Mrs. Barham, by blaming it on ministers and generals or warmongering imperialists or all the other banal bogeys. It's the rest of us who build statues to those generals and name boulevards after those ministers. The rest of us who make heroes of our dead and shrines of our battlefields. We wear our widow's weeds like nuns, Mrs. Barham, and perpetuate war by exalting its sacrifices. My brother died at Anzio.
I didn't know that, Charlie.
Yes, an everyday soldier's death, no special heroism involved. They buried what pieces they found of him. But my mother insists he died a brave death and pretends to be very proud.
You're very hard on your mother. Seems a harmless enough pretense to me.
No, Mrs. Barham. Now, you see, now my other brother can't wait to reach enlistment age. That'll be in September.
Oh, Lord.
Maybe ministers and generals who blunder us into wars, Mrs. Barham. The least the rest of us can do is to resist honoring the institution. What has my mother got for pretending bravery was admirable? She's under constant sedation and terrified she may wake up one morning, find her last son has run off to be brave. I don't think I was rude or unkind before, do you, Mrs. Barham?
Better push off, Emily, if you've got to get to work.
All right, then. There you go. So there's James Garner. We perpetuate war by exalting its sacrifices. All too true. And, of course, this is still a big problem. It will always be a problem in American society. The propaganda of the spit-upon Vietnam veteran, which, you know, it's disputed to say the least. It may have happened some. But anyway, it's the poster. It's the propaganda poster, and it's so damned effective. If you're around and paying attention at all in 2003, so effective to conflate the soldier with the policy and to, in effect, outlaw criticism of the policy on the theory that to criticize, and see how nonsensical it is, too, to criticize the soldiers who you claim the government is putting at risk for no good reason and having them kill people for no good reason is to betray them.
rather than is to look out for them a lot better than everybody who's cheering for them. You know, how the hell is it supporting the troops to have them get blown up by an IED fighting a war they should have never fought when they could be sitting on their ass back at Fort Bliss doing cocaine and, you know, getting paid tax money all day? You know, it's the anti-war people are the one who support the troops. But anyway, in the propaganda, and it's so simple. In the propaganda, support the troops, support the troops, support the troops means you better not let them get the idea that anyone in America, and again with the meaningless phrases, isn't behind them. But again, if I know better than you, and I'm telling you, don't get your son killed by signing him up to join some stupid war for the Dawa party in Iraq, then I'm the one who cares more about the soldier. I'm the one who's giving the good advice and the actual support. But people get caught up in these slogans. And I'll tell you one, people forget. You know, it's the Democrats now, those damn secular humanists or whatever. So now it's like ancient history, the days of 2003 and 2004, 2001 and 2 as well, I guess, where every conservative, not everyone, but so many conservatives would come up with this argument. And it says in Romans 13, boy, that you render unto Caesar. And that means shut up. That means you have to go along with whatever the government says. As though that's really what the Bible says, that your first loyalty is to the emperor of Rome. I'm not a religious guy, but anyone who's not a Republican could tell you that what they're saying there is that your task here on earth is worrying about your afterlife and your relationship with God. So pay your taxes because you don't care. Caesar's face is on the coin and it must belong to him. Go ahead and give it up because that's not your fight. Paying your tax when you have greater concerns, your soul, right? Nope, that means you better do whatever the Republicans say, boy, no matter what. And James Garner's right. It's the regular people who go along with this, who help the politicians create their consensus for this madness, who allow themselves to be scared and fooled time and again into these conflicts, who are ultimately responsible for